Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
One of the most exciting things about working at Hudson Institute is that our history of unconventional policy ideas brings together experts who often disagree, but engage in really intellectually rigorous and civil debates with one another.
In that spirit, we brought back senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, Michael Duran, and friend of the podcast, who recently appeared on our show to talk about the failures of the U.S. foreign policy elites, along with our colleague, Blaise Michel, whose work focuses on the Middle East, Europe, and the broader strategic picture.
The way this came about is that Blaise and Mike were on a panel here at Hudson shortly after the president announced troop withdrawal from northern Syria. They got into it pretty collegially about U.S. presence and policy in Turkey and northern Syria, as well as their views on allies and the broader dynamics in the Middle East. We wanted to have them here to draw out some of those ideas and talk about shifting U.S. policy in the region, how it should all be looked at through the context of the realignment.
Let's dive in. Michael Duran, Blaise Michel, welcome to The Realignment. So we're here to talk about U.S. policy in northern Syria, which is really about a broader conversation we think about our alliances, how long we should be engaged in the region, and sort of the broader sort of structural forces that everyone's sort of looking at right now.
Yeah, so Mike and Blaise, Mike, you just returned from a recent trip to Turkey. Blaise, you're an expert also in the region. You both disagree quite a bit about what U.S. policy in northern Syria is. This is a very complicated situation, lots of moving parts. We, of course, have the recent news of the death of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in Idlib province in Syria.
Who founded ISIS.
He was the founder of ISIS. And we also have this context while the president has withdrawn U.S. forces from northern Syria and allowed an Turkish incursion into the north. Now, Mike, you have been supportive of the president's move on that. Just give a bit of a background on what exactly the U.S. posture, in your view, there was doing, why it wasn't exactly necessary, and you're supportive of this move.
I'm supportive of the decision to pull back in the face of the Turkish pressure because I think that we were postured for failure in the region because we had allied with the YPG, the Kurdish group on the ground that we allied with. It is the PKK, which is an organization carrying out a separatist terrorist campaign in Turkey, and it's recognized by the United States as a terrorist organization, and we were therefore alienating the Turks, who we need more than anyone else in that region. So we had very unwisely gotten into bed with the sworn enemy of the Turks, and not of President Erdogan, but of the entire Turkish population. The Turks are overwhelmingly supportive of the Turkish operation in Syria.
So before, Blaise, before I get you in here, I do want to focus on why do we need that strategic strong relationship with the Turkish Republic?
It's very simple. Two presidents have been elected on the principle that we're not going to have any more George W. Bush-style invasions of the Middle East. And even before that, I mean, George W. Bush had to expend an enormous amount of capital in order to get the public to support the surge in Iraq. Mm. So we're not going to have another president go before the American people and call for a very large American military presence in the region, absent some kind of national disaster like 9/11. But we still have interests in the region, and we have to protect those interests, which means we have to work through allies. And our job is to bring order to the region. When you're not going to do it yourself and you're going to work with others, then you have to take on board the views of others. And we have to work with states first and foremost. And there are only three states that we can really work with, and that's on bringing order to the region. There are lots of nice states in the region that work with America, like Jordan and the UAE, but they're too small to build a regional order. Mm-hmm. Regional order requires Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And if we're going to work with Turkey, we have to take on board Turkey's understanding of its national security.
Mm. Blaise, did you agree with the decision to pull back American troops?
I did not agree with the decision, although I think it's important to note there's different elements. There's the way in which we withdrew, which I think was highly problematic. There is everything leading up to that decision, which I actually think the bureaucracy and U.S. policymakers failed President Donald Trump, because we know that ever since December of 2018, when he had another phone call with President Erdogan of Turkey, he said he wanted to pull out. And I think the U.S. bureaucracy had sort of put its head in the sand and was pretending that they could stop that from happening. And so part of the reason the pullout was as disastrous as it was is I think we hadn't been laying the groundwork for what President Trump had said he wanted to do. So partly it was a failure of how we managed the last 10 months. Partly it was a failure to pull out responsibly. But I do think that overall, having a presence in northeastern Syria was serving U.S. interests and should have been continued, although the way it has been executed has been problematic.
So let's get to that, though. Like, what were those? And I'd like this from both of you. What, Blaze, first, what were the American interests in northern Syria?
So I, you know, to step back, I would actually agree on some issues and disagree with Mike on others. I think very broadly, we have the interest of keeping Iranian expansion and influence in the region down, trying to roll it back, if not, then at least contain it. And for that, northeastern Syria was a very strategic sliver of territory situated between the Assad government that Iran was supporting and Iraq, where Iran also has sunk its claws deep into that government there, as well as trying to manage the role of the Middle East as part of the broader geopolitical competition that the United States is engaged in with Russia and China. And obviously, Russia has played a big role in the Syrian conflict, and so the U.S. position there played an important part in trying to limit the spread of their advantage, and China, to a lesser extent, a player in that. And obviously, there's this issue of endless wars, if you want to call it, or the scourge of terrorism, and I think the need to keep the terrorist threat down in order to enable this pivot to dealing with Russia, China, and Iran. And I think making terrorism the priority is the wrong strategic objective right now. But continuing to invest the limited resources that we were investing in northeastern Syria, we're talking about 1,000 guys and about $1 billion a year to keep this territory out of Iranian hands, to keep it out of ISIS hands, allowing us to focus our attention and our assets and resources in other places.
Now, Mike, nobody would ever accuse you, I think, of being, you know, somebody who would support a move that would enable or empower the Islamic Republic of Iran. So what would your response to that be on why this isn't a play into Iranian interests?
You have to understand that the YPG, the Kurdish group that we allied with, is the proxy of the Iranians and the Russians. Mm. We borrowed it from them when Obama went into Syria, and he did that for a very clear reason. He was trying to curry favor with Moscow and Tehran in order to get the Iranian nuclear deal, and more broadly, in order to create an environment in the region that would allow us to pull our troops out by sending a signal to Russia and Iran that didn't feel that we were in competition with them. So they kept the YPG, PKK, they kept Assad regime forces in Qamishli in the east the entire time that they were allied with us. They have always been playing both sides. And we've been happy with that because it sent a signal. It sent a signal to Damascus, Tehran, and Moscow that we were only there to destroy the Islamic State. And we didn't intend to do anything against the Assad regime. So the idea that our forces sitting in northeastern Syria were stopping the Iranian project is just not true.
Wasn't this all about ISIS, though, right? So, like, maybe... Right. So fair, we could argue that he was currying favor during the Iran deal, but also, like, we were fighting ISIS. And the argument that people who say the administration betrayed the Kurds made is that we had our allies and we betrayed them because they were leading the fight against ISIS.
Well, again, I start from the point of view that they were not our allies. We told them from the beginning that this was temporary and transactional, and they accepted that deal. And as part of the deal, we allowed them to keep their relations with the Assad regime. So what we see now, them going up under the Russians and the Assad regime, is not something that they did as an emergency measure out of a sense of panic. That was always the plan, starting back in the Obama administration. If you look at Brett McGurk, who was what Brett McGurk has been saying since Donald Trump said last December that he wanted to pull out, McGurk is saying, Trump wants to pull out. If we're going to do that, then what we should do is broker a deal with the Assad regime where we take the SDF, that is the YPG-PKK, pull them up under the Assad regime. That was the Obama worldview, which elements of the bureaucracy continued to hold on to in the Trump administration. Now, in order for those forces to be working against Iran, they would have to also. If they began to posture themselves to work against Iran, they would start to undo the relationship with the PKK.
Yeah.
And that would require more American troops, which is why Trump didn't want to do it.
What's your response to that, Blaise?
Well, first of all, I think that we have to recognize that these allegiances can be transactional, but they can also be fungible. They change. And in fact, if we are engaged in a geopolitical competition with the Russians and the Chinese, then we should be engaging with them and trying to take influence away from them and pull groups away from them in the way that they're trying to pull, for example, Turkey away from us. This is a competition for political influence, and saying that one group is or has been Russian or Iranian influence doesn't mean that it always has to be that way, and that we should therefore not try to engage with them if it is in our strategic interest to have them allied with us. If you look at the example of what we have done in northern Iraq and in the Kurdistan regional government there, those groups have a long history of being allied with Iran as well. But because of a long history of the U.S., going in and protecting those groups starting in 1991, protecting them from Saddam Hussein, giving them the room to grow politically and economically after the 2003 invasion, there has been a lot of movement away from Iran and acceptance and partnership with the United States. When the U.S. Didn't, for some good reasons, back the 2017 referendum for independence in the KRG, we saw Iran immediately.
The KRG is the Kurdish regional government
in northern Iraq. We saw Iran immediately re-enter and rebuild those relationships. And that's exactly what has happened here. We had the opportunity, and this is why I say I think we've wasted time over the last 5 years that we were in northeastern Syria. We had the opportunity to, A, both move the Syrian Kurdish groups away from the PKK, to build a broader Syrian Kurdish movement, one that wasn't just reliant on the pre-existing structures that the PKK had built, and to move that region overall further away from Iran and Russia and right. Assad. We should have done that. We were doing that to a certain extent. We could have done more of it, but to throw that away because once upon a time there was this connection, I think is misplaced.
So before we move on to the broader context, I think the way that most people think of our engagement in northern Syria was it's about ISIS. So now that al-Baghdadi is dead, where does ISIS's general status, like, how would you sort of assess their general status in the region right now? To both of you, of
sure.
course.
I mean, I think everyone would recognize that even though we took the last acre of territory that ISIS controlled back in March of this year of 2019, as an ideological force, even as an organizational force, ISIS is not spent. There remain to sleeper cells. There remain 10,000 fighters that are being held by the SDF, by the Syrian forces in northeastern Syria. Just this summer, we bombed an island in the Euphrates River, I believe, that was reported to hold 8,000 ISIS fighters. So it is a force that might be without a caliphate, without a territory, without a claims, now without a leader. But it is not a spent force by any means, nor is it the only Islamic extremist force in Syria. We have to remind ourselves that Idlib province is the domain of a number of al-Qaeda-aligned groups, some of whom are actually fighting on behalf of the Turks in northeastern Syria now.
Right.
And the conditions that allow these groups to reconstitute, to attract both money and fighters, can easily be recreated. Just like the Obama pullout from Iraq in 2011 created the opportunity for sectarian oppression that led to ISIS's rise, leaving Arab Sunni populations in Syria and Iraq to Iranian domination will once again allow these groups to rise up.
Mike, your response?
Well, I think we have to keep our eyes on the prize here. For me, if you look at this from a 50,000-foot level, there are jihadis on the ground. There's going to be jihadism. There's going to be jihadism in the Middle East and in Europe and to a certain extent in the United States until the day I die,
yeah.
I assume. But that is not that's not the strategic issue here. The strategic issue is the contest with China and Russia and Iran. Iran is spreading militias all across the region. While we have, once we said that the strategic priority in the region is the counter-ISIS campaign, that created a space into which the Iranians moved. And so we said we're going to destroy ISIS with whomever's available to us. And what we ended up doing was aligning either with militias on the ground that were directly tied to Iran, or organizations like the PKK that had very good relations with Iran. So we created we opened up a vacuum into which Iran moved, and we did nothing about it. That's the problem. And now they have these militias to which they are distributing precision-guided weaponry. And so we have a militia in Yemen that can hit Riyadh with missiles. We have Hezbollah in Lebanon that's got 100,000 rockets and missiles, which it is turning into precision weaponry, that can hit Tel Aviv. They can hit the Dimona reactor, the Dimona nuclear reactor in Israel, and a number of others, including now we see militias in Iraq that are also being armed with precision weaponry. That is the strategic threat. The strategic threat is Russia and China allied with Iran, taking over the region, dividing and conquering all of the different elements. Yeah. A great strategic prize in that contest is the orientation of Turkey. And so our alliance with the PKK in northern Syria was driving the Turks into the arms of the Russians and the Iranians. And that's the trade-off here. I mean, the Blaise said earlier that we have only 1,000 troops in northern Syria and $1 billion a year, and that's not a cost at all. No, on the cost side of the ledger is the international orientation of Turkey. Mm-hmm. That's the huge cost. That was the hidden cost that nobody wanted to admit, and we propagandized ourselves. We kept telling ourselves, "Oh no, it's not really the PKK. It's the SDF. It's not really a war with Turkey. The Turks are going to be okay with this over time." No, it was this. We were just lying to ourselves.
Mm. And so, Blaise, I think that's the real question here is about the strategic orientation of Turkey. So what we're hearing from you about the advocacy for 1,000 troops in Syria, $1 billion a year, and the ultimate pullout. Well, is there any pullout strategy? I mean, ultimately, it seems to me that what you're proposing is a multi-year presence in northern Syria for the purpose of now, for checking Iran. Previously, it was for defeating ISIS, all at the expense of what Mike is laying out here, which is a NATO ally, an important ally in the region. What's your response?
So jump in real quick. Yeah. Is Mike's perception that there's a cost true?
Right.
Right. Because what's not, I you may disagree with that presumption. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I was going to say what I would not disagree at all with the strategic threat of Iran that Mike laid out. I would not disagree as well that the United States has a strategic interest in the orientation of Turkey. I would contend that ultimately our presence in northeastern Syria, although it should have been handled better and not as reliant solely on the YPG, and we should have been building out a more representative force as we tried to a certain extent. But regardless of that, the international orientation of Turkey is not dependent and would not be dependent upon our presence in Syria because of the nature of the regime of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey is fundamentally about many things other than this issue. And just to prove that point, one simple factoid, when we began our partnership with the Syrian Kurds in 2014 to defend the city of Kobani, a Kurdish city that was under siege by ISIS, President Erdogan was engaged in probably the brightest moment of his tenure in office in Turkey, which was peace negotiations with the PKK, directly with the leader of the PKK who's imprisoned in Turkey. Mm-hmm. It would have been a historic achievement had he been able to do it. He was far along the road in that peace process when we undertook this partnership. So we were not undertaking a partnership with someone, with a group that Turkey was says, we can't talk to, they're terrorists, we have to attack them now. We were doing it in the context of a peace deal, while at the same time, Turkish intelligence was directly sending trucks full of weapons to the al-Nusra Front, the prime al-Qaeda-aligned yes. terrorist group within Syria during this same time. So this idea that the U.S. was choosing a terrorist group while Turkey was assiduously avoiding any connections to terrorism was, leading the charge on counterterrorism is just false.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would deny. Yeah. I mean, there's no good men among the living in Syria, right? I mean, this is a very, very complicated situation. I guess what we're really trying to get at is, do you disagree with that that premise about the ultimate orientation of Turkey, and that your strategy is what would keep Turkey oriented towards containing Iran.
So I'm not claiming that having troops in northeastern Syria would do that. I would contend that I don't see how it is possible for Turkey, as long as it is led by President Erdogan, to be a U.S. partner in this fight against Iran that Mike rightly contends we need to be engaged in. President Erdogan has gone to Tehran and said, this is my second home. He has spoken at length about how he sees the 1979 revolution in Iran as a precursor for the new pious generation he wants to raise in Turkey. And he is fundamentally animated by an anti-Americanism and anti-Westernism. Mm. He speaks at length of the world being greater than five. He has said he wants nuclear weapons because
What's the five in reference to?
I'm sorry, the five is the five permanent members of the UN Security Council.
Right.
And he thinks that it shouldn't just be those five, that Turkey has a seat at that table of global world powers. And in fact, it is America and the West that is oppressing Turkey and keeping it from having its rightful place at that table, including by keeping Turkey from having nuclear weapons. And he's recently said, I want nuclear weapons. Not Turkey should have nuclear weapons. I, President Erdogan, I want nuclear weapons. And I think that this idea that we can take him out of the increasingly Russian orbit that he's fallen into, we can sort of snap him out of his anti-Americanism, is a misplaced one. And I'd also go further and say, fundamentally, the Turkish incursion into northeastern Syria has nothing to do with the PKK or the YPG, but entirely has everything to do with the domestic political struggle of President Erdogan to remain in power, and we ignore that at our own peril.
What do you think? What's your response to that, Mike? Which is that, I mean, I think Blaze is making a good point here, which is that Erdogan, obviously, I mean, there's no denying that he has espoused a lot of anti-Western rhetoric over the last couple of years, and that he's generally orienting himself as an opposition to the West. Is this somebody who, is the beef here really about the YPG or PKK, as you say, or is it about somebody who needs, you know, who believes very strongly in kind of like a neo-Ottoman revanchism in the region? And is that something that a small concession of northeastern Syria policy is going to quell? What do you think?
No, I totally disagree with every word that Blaze just spoke.
Good. Let's get some clash going. Right. This is good. You've been holding back, Mike. This is very nice.
Let me just take the last statement that Blaze made and work back from that. Mm. Blaze said, this has nothing to do with the PKK. It has everything to do with domestic considerations by Erdogan. Presumably, that means that this is very popular in Turkey. So why is that? Because it's the PKK. Mm. This is the idea that Turkey as a whole was not incensed and outraged by the American policy with the PKK is self-delusion. Oh. And that's point number one. Point number two is the PKK issue, the Kurdish issue in Turkey, is the single most sensitive issue in that country's domestic politics and in its foreign policy. Turkey's foreign policy in the Middle East continues through, and it ends with this Kurdish question. So you can't say, well, we have seven different issues and Erdogan is a problem here and there, and this PKK issue is not really all that important. The PKK issue is everything. And to have the United States, the most powerful country in the world, and Turkey's primary ally, arm, train, and equip the PKK, which is what we're doing, is an absolute recipe for driving Turkey away. Not Erdogan, but Turkey. Now,
are those two things different?
Totally yes. Different. They are totally. They are. No. I'm sorry. If he's agreeing, then I disagree because I thought we need to distinguish between Turkey and Erdogan. Right. There's a young generation of nationalist Turks who are not Islamists, who are pro-American, pro-Western, pro-democracy, who are completely outraged by what the United States is doing. These are the people that we should be working with to build the relationship for the next generation, next 20, 30 years.
So let's take a broader look at the realignment context of this discussion. So, right, a lot of the way that people sort of frame this debate, right, to the actual decision to pull back from northern Syria has been around forever wars. So firstly, do you guys buy or disagree with the concept of the fact that the U.S.'s engagement in the Middle East for the past 18 or so 18 years or so constitutes a forever war? Or is there something more to that?
I'll start with you, Blaze.
Sure. You know, I think in general there's something right about that, which is to say that our continued focus on what is happening in the Middle East and continued military deployments there saps both bandwidth and resources and attention that need to be devoted to dealing with other issues. And I think in the press conference that President Trump gave to announce that al-Baghdadi had died in a U.S. raid, he actually made an argument that I heard him make in the context of the Syrian withdrawal for the first time, which I think is the right argument to be making, even though I think it doesn't apply to the withdrawal, which is Russia and China are happy that we were there because they want us bogged down.
Engaged in northeastern Syria.
I think if you say more broadly the Middle East, that sentiment is right, right? Mm. It bogs us down. It makes us devote material and personnel and resources to dealing with something that ultimately also helps them because Russia and China both benefit from us addressing the terrorist threat. China benefits from us securing the freedom of navigation and supply of energy while leaving them free to pursue their agendas elsewhere. I think that is the right framing, the right strategic approach to this. I would just disagree with the fact that the 1,000 men and $1 billion we were spending on northeastern Syria was a detraction from rather than addition to the broader global challenge of dealing with Russia, China, and Iran.
I think the real question, though, is when would they leave? What is the ultimate end state, right? Because, I mean, that is what infuriates, I think, a lot of the domestic political perspective, which is the American people have now voted in three separate presidential elections for Afghan and Iraq withdrawal, and they have not gotten that.
Quick question, though, right? You know, did Americans know that there was a presence in northern Syria before last month, right? Like, I could fully buy the idea that people are incredibly skeptical of Afghanistan.
So, I think that's the that's right. So, like, that's so, the, which is I don't know if they're incensed about Syria. They just see it in the broader context.
Northeastern Syria. Let's be precise.
Right, and northeastern Syria. And it actually it gets to a point you made earlier, which is the failure of these bureaucrats to actually acquiesce to the presidential declaration of I want out of Syria. They basically just tried to hoodwink him into several six-month more extensions. It seems that when we talk about endless war, forever war, I think I'm showing my colors here, which is that it is an advocacy of a policy of non-imagination and of path dependency. And so that's why when I hear, you know, positions much like yourself, I'm inherently skeptical because I understand how policy implementation works.
Well, so let me say that. I think that there's the question of pullouts from Iraq and Afghanistan, which, you know, we're talking about at the height of those wars, 150, 160,000 troops, very different than the Syria context. Yeah. But I think if you take the slogan, end endless wars, and you apply that through the lens of good policy and good strategic thinking, you get largely what the Obama administration to some extent, and certainly the Trump administration under the national security strategy have said, which is we shouldn't be devoting more resources and undertaking new interventions and going into new conflicts in these areas. And we should be focused instead on putting our attention elsewhere. So the question isn't, you know, you don't end endless wars by just sort of pulling out and saying, that's it. That's what we did in 2011 in Iraq, and that's how we got back into Syria in 2014. Nor is ending endless wars just say, we're not going to have troops anywhere around the world. We have tens of thousands of troops in Germany for multiple decades. The same goes for Korea. We maintain troops in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba for decades. And no one's winning elections on the call to pull those troops out, nor are we saying that they are in some way a burden to us being able to achieve our other strategic objectives. So the issue isn't about how many troops do we have where and should they be coming home, but are we focused enough on the threats as Mike has laid them out, or are we wasting our resources on something that is not serving our interest? And so I think what the charge of end endless wars is minimize the dangers from the Middle East, minimize the tension that it takes from us so we can pivot to something else. And here I'll throw down actually a big disagreement that I have with what Mike laid out. I don't think an investment in stability and order is the way to do that in the Middle East. I think the path forward for U.S. strategy in the Middle East is to recognize that the states that were created 100 years ago are failing or have already failed, that the region is falling apart, and that the United States is going to be able to best manage that, through figuring out how we work through instability and how we work with non-state forces, whether that's the SDF or others like it, for temporary and transactional partnerships serve our interest to subvert the imperial ambitions of Iran, of Russia, and China, rather than investing in trying to build up states.
Go ahead, Mike. So not only just a response to what he said about the transnational groups, but also generally on this endless war question.
What was the crazy thing he said?
Well, look, we've been involved now 18 years intensively, longer than that, really. But let's just say since 9/11, for 18 years in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. What about what we have done in Iraq and Syria that we look back on and say that was really a good job? I mean, we just went and we killed Bin Laden before, and now we went and we killed Baghdadi. Those operations are fantastic operations. We have special operations teams supported by intelligence training and equipment and everything that is just phenomenal, the best in the world. There are probably only one or two other countries that can do what we did with Baghdadi: go in, kill him. Not a single American is lost in the process. Look at that operational ability. And then look at the strategic rubble that we have left in the wake. So there's this incredible military capability that we have, and this inability to figure out how the region works. And I think that what Blaise just said, what he's saying again is we should be aligning with groups like the PKK. This makes no sense at all to me. The lesson of the last few weeks with President Erdogan is, Turkey is not going to take it. They were taking it
until we pulled back. Right?
Not true. Not true. They intervened twice. They've already intervened twice.
What were those interventions?
They intervened in Euphrates Shield, and they've been sending us. They have been sending us messages. They're in Afrin. They're in Euphrates Shield. They've been sending us very clear messages all along that they do not like what we're doing, and they're not going to.
But those were operations into areas in which the U.S. was not patrolling, and in which the U.S. had actually originally promised it would not allow the SDF to go west of the Euphrates River.
And there was broken promises
there. Yeah. But every time
the United States said it wouldn't do things, it did. So it lied to them and lost all credibility.
But ultimately, when the Turkish forces went into Jarablus and other places, those were places the U.S. was not patrolling. Every time that Turkey threatened to go into areas east of the Euphrates, when it realized it stopped.
I don't want to litigate details of operations here. I do think it's an important point.
The issue is, if you're Turkey, you're going to be next to northern Syria forever.
Yes.
And you also know the United States is not. And they can read the body language. We've already taken troops out. And Trump says, I want to get out. And the American public, Elizabeth Warren, the same day that she is decrying President Trump's decision to pull the troops out, says that she thinks we should pull all troops out of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a genius at political analysis to see that the domestic support for this operation in the United States is not great. So if you're Turkey, you have to be thinking about the day after. And they are going to destroy this project. If it's not going to be this week or next week, it's going to happen. And they have a lot of different tools for doing it, including their military. But they could also just start sending irregulars in to make our life miserable.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about then, and this is what Trump recognized. If you wanted any of the options that Blaise has laid out, stopping Turkey requires more troops and worse relations with Turkey. Working with Turkey to create a Kurdish statelet in northeastern Syria that serves Turkish interests, like the KRG and the autonomous Kurdish area in Iraq, also requires more troops. Why? Because our small, tiny footprint there, 1,000 troops, those troops are in bases, the defense of which is provided by the PKK. So our defense perimeter is from those soldiers. Mm. If we start working against, now this is that there was a dirty little deal done between the United States and the PKK, where you help us fight ISIS, and we turn a blind eye to your political project of building an independent Kurdish statelet on Turkey's border.
So four points.
Let me finish. Let me finish. And one more statement here. And so we would go. Our soldiers would go out on operations with these guys on Monday to attack ISIS, and on Tuesday these guys would go about building Rojava, the independent Kurdistan. If we worked with the Turks to dismantle, to make sure that there will not be Rojava, will never rise up, we lose our defense perimeter with them. Mm. And remember, they've always kept relations with Iran and Syria. So suddenly they're threatening to us. What do we do about that threat? Well, we need more troops. So any way you square this, Trump realized that we're going to get sucked into either a conflict with Assad or a conflict with Assad and the Russians, mm, or a conflict with the Turks. And it's going to require a lot more troops with no end in sight to that, mm, to that engagement. And in that sense, he said, I want to pull the plug on this entirely because I don't see any victory down this path.
Blaze, let's approach it from that frame, which is that an accurate characterization?
No, absolutely not. Okay. So three points on this Turkey-Syria thing, and then I want to return us to the broader strategic conversation with a fourth point. So first point, what Mike was talking about, which was deconflicting with the Turks, trying to provide for their security guarantees and providing a buffer zone on the border so that they would feel safe, is precisely what we have been doing with Turkey since August of 2019, where we struck a deal with them that we would provide for a safety corridor, that we would undertake joint patrols and that with the Turkish forces on the border to make sure the border was not being crossed by Syrian Kurdish forces, and moving Syrian Kurdish forces and their weapons back from the border. So that process was already in place. Second, there was not going to be a forthcoming Turkish invasion. It was a bluff on Erdogan's part. How do we know that? Erdogan and Trump had a phone call on Sunday in which Erdogan said, I'm invading right now. You better get out of the way. President Trump tweets and makes a decision right away to withdraw. When does the Turkish invasion actually happen? Not until Wednesday. Mm. We suddenly found Erdogan with his pants down because we didn't call his bluff. And suddenly he now has to mount an offensive that he was not prepared to actually mount. Third point, Mike is absolutely right that Turkey has to live with northern Syria on its border forever, and that they don't want a foreign power arming the PKK and agitating it against Turkey from within northern Syria. So let's think back to the last time that happened. Oh, that was the 1990s when the Assad family was playing host to Abdullah Öcalan, the leader of the PKK, and was allowing the PKK to hold its training bases and camps and use Syrian territory to attack Turkey from across the border at a time when more than half of the weapons the PKK was using were coming from Russia. Mm. And so Turkey accuses us of arming the PKK against it, and instead has ended up with the Syrian Kurdish territory held by the people who have actually armed and used the PKK against it. So I think that, if anything, by handing over this territory, we have made the Turks more insecure, and we've put it in the hands of the Assad government, which hates Erdogan now and is more likely to use the PKK against Turkey than we ever were going to.
So to take a step back, though, we're talking about a NATO ally here, Turkey. Right. And this also goes to like a broader conversation we sort of have, which is that a lot of the institutions and sort of military alliance structures that we've had since World War II ended either are or aren't up to date or need to be sort of changed. What is your guys' perspective on that question specifically with Turkey? Right, because at the end of the day, like we're getting wonky here, which I really enjoy, but we're talking about very deep-seated conflict we have with an ostensible ally. Right. How does that work? How does that relationship work? And how does the alliance itself work with the NATO?
Well, I'll just say this. I think Mike and I are aligned with the fact that we are better off with Turkey being part of NATO. They should be a strategic ally of the United States. If we want to succeed against Iran, against Russia, I think we're better off having Turkey. I think that doesn't mean Erdogan. That means whatever comes next, we should be competing for the future of Turkey. And I do think Mike is right that that means reaching out to the young generations of Turkey to make sure that they are not imbibing this anti-Americanism that Erdogan is selling. I think where we disagree is about this. Is the future of Turkey as an American ally determined by Turkey's foreign policy or domestic policy? And I would contend that it has nothing to do or little to do with what the U.S. is doing in Syria or Iraq or anywhere else around the Middle East, and everything to do with the nature of Turkey's democracy. And if we allow for the demise of Turkey's democracy, if we allow for the continued rise of virulent Turkish, not just Islamism, but nationalism, then we are casting this this ally on a path that is going to lead it away from us. And the surest way to do that is to perpetuate the Turkish-Kurdish conflict. Because what we have done is ensured now that this conflict is going to continue not just in Syria, but inside Turkey for generations to come. Erdogan's brightest moment, and the one thing that he was right about politically, is that Turkey's founding constitution was fundamentally not capable of resolving this conflict. And that if Turkey was going to evolve past its limited democracy, it needed to deal with and reconcile the Turks and the Kurds into a single coherent polity. He did a lot of work to get down that road, and then he turned his back on it and declared war against the PKK once again.
We totally undermined that.
We need to get past that.
We totally undermined that. Our, by making an alliance with the PKK and giving it international legitimacy, arming, training, and equipping it without making any demand, any political demands on it whatsoever, we actually encouraged it in taking an extreme line rather than taking a taking a more conciliatory line. We could very easily have conditioned our support on them accepting certain Turkish presence in northern Syria, certain power sharing relationships with other Kurdish groups. We could have gone into, for example, originally Obama had the choice to go into northern Syria with the Peshmerga, with the Barzani Kurds from Iraq, with whom we have a good relationship and with whom the Turks have a good relationship. But we didn't do that. Why? Because the PKK has a horrible relationship with Barzani. So we would have had to enter into a Kurdish conflict. Now we could have sat on the PKK and demanded that they get along with their Kurdish brothers. They prefer, and you can see that this is what's going on right now. It's very important to understand what's happening right now. They prefer the relationship with Assad and the Russians than to a relationship with Barzani. And we were quite happy with that.
Speak a bit more, though, Mike, to the broader orientation, I guess, of our relationship with Turkey and within NATO.
On this, Blaze is totally... Yeah. I'm sorry, Blaze, you're totally wrong.
Can we just note something? He said you guys were going to agree.
He said you guys were going to agree.
No. We're right on the importance of keeping Turkey in NATO, but Blaze is absolutely 100% wrong on the question of the PKK driving Turkey away from the United States. This is and we're not talking about Erdogan. We're talking about Turkey. This issue, like I said before, has an absolute special status. You cannot find in Turkey a self-respecting Turk, pro-Erdogan or anti-Erdogan, who supports what the Americans are doing and thinks that Erdogan is crazy for what
he's
doing.
So are the 15 million Kurds in Turkey not self-respecting Turks?
There are many Kurds who will support Erdogan on this. Being Kurdish and being pro-PKK are not the same thing.
Right. I mean, I think that's been evidenced through the Iraqi situation.
There are 3,600,000 refugees in Turkey from the Syrian war.
Right.
A significant percentage of them, a significant number of them, I don't know the total number, how many hundreds of thousands it is, are Kurds who are refugees from northern Syria who can't go back because the PKK doesn't like them.
And I think that's an important dynamic to recognize just how complicated this is. Blaze, I do want to get to some of the language and the rhetoric you were using, which is we cannot allow Turkey to go on this path. I mean, this speaks to, I think, a broader strategic question that Trump and many of the domestic populace is frustrated with, which is, why is it the United States' business to determine the domestic political trajectory of Turkey? I mean, we are rightfully outraged at attempts by foreign governments to do the same to us. So, I mean, just explain your thinking on that issue.
Sure. I mean, I think there's a difference between interference in elections and concern about the political direction that an ally is taking. But it goes back to this question of how are we going to fight this global geopolitical competition against Russia and China? And I think Mike is absolutely right that in order to fight it, then we have to be willing to fight for our allies and fight for countries that are important to our ability to wage that struggle. Do we have to give up Turkey, or do we have to engage with Turkey's domestic politics? No, we don't have to, but we're going to be better off in our ability to deal with the Middle East and with Russia if Turkey's on our side. Mm. And I think what that means is showing Turkey that we do, and Turks, that we do care about the direction their country is going. I think the trap that we have fallen into repeatedly, three administrations now have believed that Erdogan is the savior of U.S. policy in the Middle East. President George W. Bush believed that Erdogan was a liberal democratic reformer and that in pursuit of the freedom agenda, Turkey was going to be a model of the Middle East, that in fact a Muslim-majority country can have a successful and prosperous democracy. And so he relied on Erdogan as sort of the proof that the freedom agenda can work. President Barack Obama, his first foreign trip was to Turkey, where he went and spoke before the Turkish parliament and said, look, the fact that you as a Muslim-majority country are an ally of the United States is the sort of proof that we need that the U.S. can reset its relations with the Muslim world after all the bad that Bush has done. And so he looked to Erdogan to be sort of his reconciler to the Muslim world. President Donald Trump has now done a similar turn where he said, look, I want out of the Middle East. I need this business taken care of. I need someone to deal with ISIS. I need someone to deal with our problems there. I'm going to look to Turkey to solve our problems there. And I think fundamentally, they've all been wrong about Erdogan. And I think what we need to show Turkey is that we care about Turkey not just to do our dirty work or not just to be an extension of U.S. interests in the Middle East, but that we care about Turkey because we care about its continued political development and we care about its society enjoying the benefits that Western societies enjoy. That means standing up for Turkey's inclusion in the European Union, which European countries continue to deny it, and showing Turks that we actually care about their democracy, that we're not just going to accept whatever autocracies and abuses of power Erdogan wants to engage in because it suits our interest to have him do what we want in the Middle East.
So before we move on to sort of what's next in the region, Mike, when we were talking about this episode, you actually brought up an interesting argument, which was that your critique of much of our policy over the last 10 years is that too often we've sort of preferenced proxy, like alliances of proxy groups, whether that's the YPG or the PKK, like non-state actors, over alliances with sort of tangible countries that we have like deeper strategic commitments to. So could you sort of expand on that argument? And I'd just love to hear what you had to say about that, Blaise.
Yeah, the issue with the PKK in northern Syria, we got the proxy relationship all wrong. They were providing our defense perimeter. And so we didn't make any political demands on them at all. We only made military demands on them. And in return, we became their lawyer to the Turks. And that is why this was so dangerous for Erdogan. It's not simply that we're arming and training and equipping a terrorist organization and giving it strategic depth in a neighboring country. There was that too. But it was also the international legitimacy of having the United States supporting it. So the proper way to do this is to start with our ally and to work within the framework of our ally's needs. And if there are issues that we have, humanitarian concerns or other concerns about what the proxy is doing that involve the proxy on the ground, then we become the lawyer of the ally to the proxy. And we explain to the proxy that you'll get our support if you do X, Y, and Z. We got it all backwards. And as a result, you know, even Donald Trump in the latest letter he sent to, in the letter that was publicized to Erdogan, he said, you know, I talked to General Mazlum and he's ready to cut a deal. This is an insult to Erdogan. This is exactly why the Turks are going into northern Syria. Mazlum is an assumed name of a guy who has been a lifelong member of the PKK. He's the adopted son of Abdullah Öcalan, the founder of the PKK. So what Erdogan hears, and not just Erdogan, every Turk hears, you're putting the president of Turkey on the same level in a negotiation with a terrorist thug. Mm-hmm. And you're pretending that that's not what he is. That's just a horrible insult to an allied country.
And I think it also, I mean, in your previous, your debut on the realignment, what you talked about was that you believe that the primary actors in global politics are nation states. And that this, are states. And that is what a lot of what I'm hearing here. Yeah, just expand on that.
Yeah, no, because we, 9/11 made us strategically stupid. Mm. It's like the end of the Cold War and then 9/11 made us strategically stupid. And this is another point where I disagree rather vehemently with Blaise. It's not our job to turn the world into democracies. In fact, I think that the one thing that we can look at, especially in the Middle East, is that our experience of trying to do that over the last 18 years has been pretty miserable. I don't think anyone looks at what we have done and said, wow, you really made that into a much more pluralistic and democratic place. Now, if you look at the Muslim Middle East, Turkey is the most stable, the most democratic, it has the greatest respect for minorities. By any standard you want to look at, Turkey is the best that exists. And we're going to go lecture to Turkey and tell Turkey how to make itself
standards like the highest, the greatest number of journalists jailed anywhere in the world. That's a high standard of democracy, right?
You want to compare Turkey to Iraq?
But Turkey's a NATO ally. I mean, that's you want to compare.
Well, we're
Turkey
talking
to
about values now, not alliance.
But
status.
Do you want to compare Turkey to Iraq? Look at what's happening in Iraq as we're talking.
Yeah, people are able to take to the streets as opposed to being jailed for tweeting their opposition to their government's policies.
They're being shot in the dozens by the security services of our ally. There's no comparison between Turkey and Iraq, Turkey and any other country you want to look at. None. No comparison whatsoever. This is the most sophisticated, the most pluralistic, the most stable, the most democratic country that we've got. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. But who do we really think that we're going to be the ones to go and change them and make them perfect? This is and look after our interests at the same time. Let's start with our interests.
Yeah, no, right. I agree, Mike. I agree. First of all, I never said that we should be going out and making countries democratic. I said that showing concern for the health of Turkey's democracy is the best bet we have for convincing Turkey's youth and Turkish society that their interests lie with America and not somewhere else for whenever Erdogan passed from the stage. But let me go back to this. I think what you pointed out about the Middle East is exactly why your state-centric approach is the wrong approach for this region. And going back to the earlier question about endless wars, what have we wasted $8 trillion on? We wasted it on trying to build states, on trying to build governing institutions, on trying to build democracy in the region. Clearly, that is a failed approach. And so rather than investing more in trying to preserve the stability of state actors, of saying we are going to do everything to make sure that these states and these borders and these institutions that were created 100 years ago continue in the way that they are, we should say, you know what? It is not in our power and it's not in our interest to stand up for this order. If there's going to be state failure, that's fine. We are going to stand on the side of working with people who can help us subvert the goals of our enemies and our adversaries. And unfortunately, if that means that there's going to be greater instability in the region, then that goes along with it. But we can't assume that we're going to be able to rebuild that order or maintain, you know, whether that is Egypt or Saudi Arabia or other regional countries as states, if the dynamics of the region are pulling them apart.
Go ahead, Mike.
A couple things. Number one, Turkey wasn't built 100 years ago. The Turkish state has roots that go back to the Yasa of Genghis Khan. This is an extremely significant, substantial political unit with a very, very long history, unlike Iraq, Syria, and otherwise. So we have to, it deserves only on the basis of that history, it deserves a degree of respect that other units in the region don't. Secondly, just imagine if the roles were reversed, and if the Turks were more powerful and they were reaching into the United States and they were supporting a Navajo. I'm just bear with me here. A Navajo rights organization that was carrying out terrorist attacks inside the United States, and we said, please don't arm, train, and equip that Navajo rights organization. And Turkey said, you know, you have really a horrible history with the Navajo, right? Do you really want to defend your history with the Navajo? We're here to help you. get along better with the Navajo. And we want to intervene between you and the Navajo and teach you how to deal with them better. I ask you, seriously, you know the United States, is that going to help Navajo, non-Navajo relations in the United States? What is that going to be good for the Navajos? Was it wise for the United States to go into northern Syria and align itself with a minority group in that area temporarily, and then take a little splinter terrorist organization from within that minority group and build that up in a temporary and transactional way? Did we do the Kurds a favor by doing that? Did we do Kurdish-Turkish relations in a favor? Did we do stability in the United in the Middle East a favor? The answer, of course, is no, 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 no. Mm-hmm. We were fomenting, inadvertently, and with all these wonderful, great intentions we have to be good people, we were fomenting a Kurdish-Turkish war and creating frictions between Kurds and Turks inside Turkey, and then telling ourselves all along that we're really good for doing that.
So
it's crazy.
On this note, then, we're about to wrap up, but in all fairness to everyone's perspectives,
yes,
1 minute or less for both of you, what is the way forward over the next year? Because I think that's a meet, because we just threw a lot of stuff at a lot of people who are listening. What do you, starting with Blaze and then you, Mike, what do you think is the path forward?
I think, first of all, we have to accept that the U.S. withdrawal from northeastern Syria has happened. I don't think we should be agitating to reinsert U.S. forces there, particularly now that Russia and Assad are there. I think President Trump has made the wise decision to maintain some forces in eastern Syria and western Iraq, both for the counter-ISIS mission, but also, and more explicitly, to counter Iranian influence in some of these areas. Mm. I think that is absolutely right. I think that we should not look and expect there to be some revitalization of U.S.-Turkish relations as a result of this. If anything, we've seen Erdogan spit on Turkey and be proud of the fact that he spit on the United States and be proud of the fact that he kicked the U.S. out of northeastern Syria. So I don't think we should be expecting a lot there. But I do think we should be looking to maintain our relations with the Kurds in Iraq. We should be looking to foment instability in areas that Iran controls. And so the protests that we've seen in Lebanon, that we've seen in Iraq, are probably our best bet going forward to try to make sure that we can limit Iranian influence throughout the region.
Hmm. Mike, go ahead.
So we have to now balance the Turks and the Iranians. That's the key issue, and the Turks and the Russians. Whether we can bring Turkey back into the strategic prize is the U.S.-Turkish relationship. That is where we should focus our attention. Whether we can bring the Turks back into a position where they trust the United States and where we work together to solve Turkey's security dilemmas in Syria is an open question. I think that Erdogan is going to triangulate now between Russia and the United States. That's our fault. We put Russia on his border, and he has no choice, in a sense, but to triangulate. Of course, he's going to want to do it a little bit more because of the loss of trust with the United States. I think we should try to rebuild trust, particularly between the military. CENTCOM, the central command that's in charge of our wars in the Middle East, hates Turkey, and this is a real problem. The trust between the Turkish military and CENTCOM has been all but destroyed. Mm-hmm. There's still trust between UCOM and
UCOM
Turkey,
is
European Command, yeah, which is traditionally had responsibility for the Turkish relationship, but it doesn't have responsibility for the Middle East.
Right.
I think that very considerable attention needs to be paid in the short term to the mill-to-mill relationship and coming up with a way to overcome this divide between CENTCOM and Turkey. I'll leave it to the military experts to figure out exactly how to do that, but that is the number one thing that we can do.
All right, well, I mean, this has been an exciting debate between the two of you, and I think it really just demonstrates that the future of the U.S.-Turkish alliance is not something, it's something that very much fits in a broader strategic framework. So thank you both so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for coming, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You're all right.
Sorry, last word. That's all.
What was it? What'd you say?
You're wrong, Mike. Oh.
Thanks for joining us. You can check out the panel Hudson hosted on the Syria Drawdown by clicking the link in the show notes or going to hudson.org. As always, subscribe and rate us 5 stars.
We'll see you next week.